Hi, and welcome to episode 10 of the Unpacking Weight Science podcast called The Non-Diet Approach Model. I'm your host, Fiona Willer, weight neutral professional development dietitian, academic and size acceptance advocate. Today is the non-diet approach model, where I'll take you through the clinical model that I've developed during my PhD research. This model is a weight neutral, size inclusive, body acceptance practice framework for clinicians who work one-on-one, but can also be adapted for working with groups and populations too. So the learning goals today are: appreciate the sources used to develop the non-diet approach model, identify the five practice principles and theoretical framework of the non-diet approach, and identify strategies which are consistent with the non-diet approach model components. This model took a long time to develop, and I'm going to talk about how it came to be, as well as the principles and the underlying theoretical framework. So I became a dietitian about 11 years ago now, and I bought a private practice 6 months after graduating. And I wanted to do this stuff, this weight neutral, size acceptance, health at every size stuff, since I had read a wonderful book by Dr. Rick Kausman called If Not Dieting, Then What? And so I wanted to use it in practice, but I didn't know how to. And I was also undergoing mindfulness treatment for my own eating issues, which was working absolutely beautifully at the time. And I'd done projects on mindful eating during my clinical prac in my last year of university before I was qualified. So I was really enthusiastic. But at that point, I still thought that body acceptance and eating mindfully would result in sort of natural weight loss. So that was the point at which my head was at back then. Now, around the same time as I bought that private practice, I also started tutoring at my alma mater. And since I was in private practice and working at a hospital full time, I got to do the weight management lecture for third year dietetic students because nobody else wanted to do it. It turned out that I absolutely loved the academic life. Hospital work was exciting and felt important and technical, saving lives. And private practice was great, but frustratingly heavy in admin time and time management. So lecturing and tutoring was an exhilarating blast, and I love and still love practicing making complicated subjects understandable and watching students grow into critical thinkers. And I also like marking assignments. I don't like the limited time we get to mark assignments, but I do like marking them. And when you work in the university system, you can't go up the career ladder without a PhD. And when people like you, you can't walk around without a PhD without getting hassled about when you're going to do one so that you can get a permanent appointment. So finally, in 2011, I put in my application to do a PhD and I started in 2012. And I wanted to see the impact that a weight-inclusive approach like Health at Every Size or Intuitive Eating had when it was delivered in a dietetic context. And that's still what my PhD is doing, although the methods of answering my question have changed a bit since the first proposal. Right, so in order to look at the impact of this kind of intervention, I needed to define the intervention in a dietetic context. And at that point, there wasn't a how-to guide for dietitians. The approach was not talked about openly on dietitian listservs without getting fierce pushback from weight loss dietitians. And the professional association behaved like Hayes was mystical pseudoscience while they advertised the profession positioning weight loss expertise as our primary service to the public. There was a time that I was afraid that we weren't allowed to practice in this way. It felt like committing dietetic heresy, even though it's not like I was telling people to drown puppies or anything. Literally all the advice I gave back then was the same as every dietitian would give somebody in a smaller body. How could that advice be instantly irrelevant or irresponsible when given to somebody in a larger body? So anyway, I needed to define what weight neutral practice was in dietetic practice. So in order to define it, I looked at academic literature. So what academics were writing for other academics about this approach. That is, approaches that focus on the adoption of health enhancing behaviours at any weight and without the expectation or celebration of weight loss. I looked at what academics and clinicians were writing about in books for their colleagues and in books for the public as well. So in terms of academic rigor, it's one step down, still written by academics and clinicians, people with technical expertise, but written for the public, a public audience rather than in a peer-reviewed journal. And then I also looked at my own clinical experience So by that point, I had been in private practice for like 3 or 4 years. And I talked to my colleagues who were taking a size inclusive approach as well. And I tried to put it all together. I didn't look at what lay people or non-academics and non-clinicians were writing about for other lay people. In retrospect, I kind of wish I had, although the other sources did include this discussion of lived experiences. But to make academic muster, I had to focus on the most rigorous academic descriptions. And there's some fantastic personal accounts of size acceptance out there, but also a whole heap of actual BS, like attractive people with field opinions and unearned confidence who get book deals. And it turns out that the non-diet approach model derived from the sources I used does hold up when personal accounts of lived experiences are considered. So, yay. Okay, so I looked at all of these sources and I did what's called a thematic analysis to define the domains of interest, which basically means I tried to find the common ground in all of these sources. What was everyone talking about? What components were characteristic of this kind of approach? And what I found was that everybody encouraged personal autonomy. That is, that people get to choose what they're going to do. This approach does not rely upon anyone giving a client prescriptive orders, and they get to set the pace. The focus is on curiosity and experimentation, discarding things that don't work at that time, experimenting and keeping an open mind about behaviour change. So in these approaches, the concepts of compliance and non-compliance or adherence and non-adherence are inappropriate. If the client hasn't ended up doing the thing that they'd planned to do by the next appointment, it's likely that it was the thing that was an unrealistic expectation or unfeasible rather than the client being intentionally errant. So you can see how that the power structure of the consultation is really different from one where the clinician assesses the person's situation, makes a clinical judgment and provides structured advice about what are the things that the person should focus on, even if they do negotiate which ones of a list of things the clinician has provided in order to give the impression of choice. In that structure, the clinician is the one in charge, the one with power, and the client is a relatively passive recipient of this sage advice. The client may have learned some new things about their condition, they may have enjoyed the conversation, but they haven't been provided much autonomy. That power differential makes people less able to speak up about things that they think won't work, as they can be nervous, that they'll be chided, or they assume that the clinician must know what's best for them. In weight-neutral size acceptance approaches, the client and the clinician had something more like a supportive partnership. With the clinician offering education where needed, but mostly support for autonomy building and problem solving in the client. This is literally how motivational interviewing and acceptance and commitment therapy work. Essentially, this means that the non-diet approach is underpinned by a theory called self-determination theory. It's a core human motivation theory. And specifically, the non-diet approach aims to assist clients to find internal autonomy, doing things based on internal reasons, like focusing on doing things that they've found that help their body to feel well physically, rather than due to external factors like aiming to manipulate body appearance or please a clinician. And in addition to this personal autonomy factor, a theme of supporting self-compassion was apparent. That is, understanding that many people have struggled in the same way that they have, that they are more than just their thoughts and feelings, they have inherent value for simply existing, not from how they look or how productive or successful others think they are, and fostering a habit of speaking to oneself with kindness, as you would a beloved friend, child, or pet, rather than harshly, like we tend to do thanks to the conditioning of criticism that some of us get while we grow up. Self-determination and self-compassion provide the substrate of growth in all of the 5 practice principles that I'm about to talk about. They're essentially the how of the non-diet approach. In terms of the what or the content, I found that most sources talked about appetite, eating, food, movement, and body image. They all called for accepting and embracing these factors. The general pattern was that fostering internal cues for eating and debunking weight loss diets was covered initially, moving to body image issues, movement, and finally to a more flexible approach to nutrition. So I grouped them into 5 practice principles, and this is what I call them. So they're all accept and embrace body cues, accept and embrace all foods, accept and embrace body shape, accept and embrace movement, and accept and embrace non-diet nutrition. And I didn't want to have to wait 6 years to be able to share this stuff. So I published it as the Non-Diet Approach Guidebook for Dietitians, essentially what I would have loved to have had available when I was starting out with this approach. And then a year later, I wrote the Non-Diet Approach Guidebook for Psychologists and Counsellors with my amazing friend, clinical psychologist Louise Adams, who developed the Untrapped program and has the All Fired Up podcast, where she has guests on to roast weight loss industry BS. The non-diet approach is not a program, it's not a manualized treatment, it's a model for clinical practice to help clinicians map out their focus points and organize their thoughts, sort of define what they're doing with the client, and to help clients feel the corners and textures of the approach and build an understanding of what dimensions that they'll be working on if they continue on with the counseling. Because it's based on a comprehensive academic literature review, it can be used to develop group interventions or public health campaigns which are consistent with weight-neutral lifestyle interventions that have come before. And we have an evidence-informed idea about the efficacy and safety of the approach when used this way. Clinicians can also use the model to self-assess their competence or their educational materials or programs that they're engaged to deliver. So I'm going to go through those five practice principles now. And the first one, if you remember, is accept and embrace body cues. This practice principle is about appetite awareness, about becoming familiar with your own personal hunger, fullness, and neutral body signals, as well as the cues your body sends you about all of its needs, needs for sleep, excretion, sex, thirst, taste, warmth, etc. Weight loss dieting is essentially practice in turning off awareness for a heap of these factors. So people who have a long history of dieting are often quite disconnected from their body signals. And we have this cultural belief that particularly our appetite signals are not to be trusted. As born out of this rhetoric of body warfare and fear of weight gain, we have this perception that our body is one lapse in willpower away from ending up on the biggest loser. But that's not true. Appetite cues are no different from our other cues. It's the only way our body can communicate its needs to us. A reminder here too that we have no way in medical and health science at the moment to be able to accurately test hunger or appetite without asking the person. There's no blood test, breath test, biometric test, or algorithm that can accurately assess somebody's hunger or fullness levels, or for that matter, whether somebody's feeling nauseous or has the need to wee. And yes, we can see with an ultrasound if there's urine in the bladder, but we can't predict that somebody is feeling like they need to wee. That's by definition a subjective measure. These signals are ours alone. Appetite intensity fluctuates over hours, days, weeks, and seasons, and it's totally normal and still undetectable by objective tests. Which also means that there's no external means to assess how much of what to eat to satisfy the hunger at that particular point in time. Knowing this makes the concept of eating plans and even dietary guidelines that stipulate particular serving sizes seem pretty sketchy. So, in Accept and Embrace Body Cues, there are strategies like hunger fullness awareness, mindful eating, eating situational awareness, reconnecting with the physical sensations of your body. And this can include education around the science of proprioception, gastrointestinal function, and mechanics of taste, acuity, and pleasure, if that's what the client is into. The next principle of the non-diet approach is accept and embrace all foods. And while it's true that some foods offer more in terms of nutrient density than others, this principle reminds us that normal eating is flexible and satisfying. Dieting not only trains us to disconnect from our body cues, but also trains us to see different foods and eating behaviours in a value hierarchy, with good foods and good eating behaviours at the top of the should list, and bad foods and bad eating behaviours in the bucket of shouldn'ts. And thinking back to the last episode, which talked about our various moral lenses and values, the value judgments that we make about food can be based on just about anything. Food considered by some to be good can be on their good food list for reasons as varied as it's clean, whatever that means, it's green, it's gluten-free, it's vegan, it's in the dietary guidelines, it makes my body feel good, it makes my body feel bad, which must mean it's good, it's part of my religion, it's healthy, it's natural, it's scientifically engineered, it's medicinal, it's what somebody that I look up to eats, it's an ancient food, it's a new food, it's what my family eats, it's what is on the diet plan, it's meant to stave off cancer, it's what cavemen, white men, rich men eat, etc., etc., like, just pick a reason and somebody will have justified a dietary choice based on it. But honestly, take it from me as a dietitian. Food is food firstly because our bodies can derive energy and nutrients from it to continue our existence. It's not heroin, it's not cardboard. Food is physiologically useful for the body to be able to carry out its metabolic functions. All the other things from that point have some importance, but are absolutely and completely down to cultural conditioning and individual quirks. There's no universal good, bad food list because that's not how a body operates. Food is morally neutral by definition until we layer all of our field opinions and experiences all over it. So in this principle, we work on breaking down the food value dichotomy, unpacking the baggage that we've unnecessarily attached to various foods, and work on understanding that dieting entrenches the kind of thinking that blocks people from normal, flexible, enjoyed eating experiences. We talk about what eating means to them, what function food and eating has in their lives, and what's getting in the way of being calm, curious, and flexible with food choices. And there's no food that's actually bad for you except actually spoiled or rotten food. All other foods have their place in the approximately 80 to 100,000 eating events you'll have if you live until you're 70. The third practice principle is accept and embrace body shape. This principle focuses on improving body appreciation and body shape acceptance. For some, it means unpacking body image issues, discussing cultural aesthetic ideals, advertising methods, capitalism, feminism, activism, weight stigma, body liberation. There's usually some work to do around decreasing internalized weight stigma, where someone has used their body shape as a justification for devaluing themselves and self-censoring their participation in the world. Make no mistake, internalized weight stigma would not exist without these same messages coming from the weight-biased cultural soup that we live in. But when you've got an individual in front of you, it is the internalized stuff that needs gentle inspection. It's pretty similar to internalized misogyny, where a woman believes that she can't be good at or participate in certain things because she's a woman. She's come to believe devaluing cultural messages about herself because of her identification as a woman, and consciously or subconsciously imposes limitations on her own opportunities and participation in life. Again, of course, limitations on participation and opportunity can be imposed externally too. In the now famous words of Hannah Gadsby in her incredible show Nanette, there's nothing more powerful than a woman that has rebuilt herself. And this body image work is exactly that. It's like the frickin' power of Grayskull, supporting people to grow into fierce self-advocates. Maslow would have considered it to be an important step towards self-actualization. Other more practical strategies in this practice principle include things like broadening exposure to people with diverse bodies, particularly to other people with bodies similar to the clients, curating social media feeds to remove diet content and replace it with size acceptance and body positive content, encouraging a purge of clothing that doesn't fit right now or that they don't want to wear for whatever reason. I always think of Marie Kondo here. She's a minimalist who recommends turfing anything that doesn't spark joy. If there's nothing in the wardrobe that fits the sparking joy description and the person wants to wear clothing that makes them feel good, then it's off to the shops or online, high street tailor, op shop, clothes swap, whatever, to get some clothes that spark at least a little joy. The fourth practice principle is accepting and embracing movement. This is probably the most straightforward one theoretically, but people can come with exercise baggage too. And for some people, physical activity or certain physical activities can be too much like dieting or eating disordered behaviour because it's sold to people in larger bodies as something to do to burn calories or change body shape, rather than for the enjoyment of it or physical strength, skills and fitness that come from it. Essentially, don't move your body unless you want to. And if you want to, look around and experiment to find something that you like or lots of things that you like that feasibly fit into your life and budget. The non-diet approach supports health outcomes, and regular physical activity is an evidence-based means to enhance health outcomes and quality of life for people who are into it. And finally, the last practice principle is accept and embrace non-diet nutrition. Back to food again, after a break to address body image and physical activity. It's listed as the last of the principles because if nutrition is considered too early, it's too easy to slip back into diet, good food, bad food thinking. Non-diet nutrition is just that. How to achieve nourishment when body weight and fear of weight gain is taken out of the equation. What kind of advice is given to weight stable, lower weight people when they seek advice about nourishment?
Nourishment from food is about sustained food variety. We know that a diverse diet is more likely to provide adequate nourishment, and we know that greater food variety is associated with a longer life, better quality of life, less chronic disease, and better managed chronic disease when they do occur. So this principle encourages food literacy, food preparation skills, experimentation with different foods and flavours, and expansion of their food universe. I can hear the nutritionists and dietitians wondering how one might deliver a therapeutic diet in this context. Like, for instance, if somebody needs to modify their diet because their kidneys aren't functioning at full tilt, or they're having a bone marrow transplant, or they have food allergies, or if they want to try to decrease their cholesterol or blood pressure levels. Well, all of this can still take place in the context of therapeutic diet considerations. The goal is to reach the most dietary flexibility and nutrition quality of life possible within medical constraints. And that's not a really very controversial dietetic goal. The only situations where the non-diet approach isn't indicated is in people with taste and acuity problems, or persistent nausea and anorexia nervosa and malnutrition before renourishment that has been achieved, and also people experiencing food insecurity. All of these things get in the way of being able to attend to body cues or other principles. So weight neutral, size inclusive, size acceptance lifestyle approaches, like those from which the non-diet approach was sublimated, have been most validated at this stage in white middle class adult women with BMIs greater than 25. So there you have it. The non-diet approach model, a framework for applying weight neutral, size acceptance approaches in clinical practice with individuals. The diagram of the model can be found on my website, healthnotdiets.com, as well as in the supporting materials for this episode. And there's more again in my books, The Non-Diet Approach Guidebook for Dietitians and The Non-Diet Approach Guidebook for Psychologists and Counsellors. If you prefer workshops or online courses, those are available too. And just see my website again, healthnotdiets.com, for details. So that's it for this episode. The supporting materials, which include the show notes, research links, and self-test quiz, are available upfront for current subscribers, only $5 a month, which is a total bargain, or can be purchased in a bundle if you're catching up later. See unpackingweightscience.com for details. Next time, I'm going to take you through some components of the science of human persuasion with unboxing wellness marketing. As my following on Instagram grew, I started getting approached by health and wellness brands to spruik their products, and one lot even sent me some samples of their product to try without asking if I wanted them. They came with a lovely letter and some product information filled to the brim with reasons why their product should be in every home across the country. So I'm going to dissect their arguments for your listening pleasure and highlight the tricks used in wellness food marketing to persuade us to open our wallets and our mouths for just about anything. So until next time, goodbye.